If we can adjust how students engage, how people engage with them, will that shift this ecosystem in a way that they will then, for the times in which they have control over why they're absent, that maybe they make a different choice?
Welcome to Learning Unboxed, conversation about teaching, learning, and the future of work. I'm your host and chief goddess of the PASS Foundation, Annalise Corbin. We know the current model for education is obsolete. It was designed to create fleets of assembly line workers, not the thinkers and problem solvers needed today. We've seen the innovations that are possible within education, and it's our goal to leave the box behind and reimagine what education can look like in your own backyard. Welcome to Learning Unboxed. As always, I'm excited to talk with another great innovator in the transformative education space. And today we're going to be talking about chronic absenteeism. And we all know globally that we are struggling with this. So we're not going to call this a positive disruptor, but we are going to acknowledge the disruption that this is having in the lives of kids and families, communities, and schools. And so joining us today to talk with us is Amber Hum Patnode, who is the acting director for the Proving Ground at Harvard. So Amber, welcome to Learning Unboxed.
Thank you, Annalise. I'm happy to be here.
Excellent. And as always, let's set a little bit of context for our listeners as we get started. So Proving Ground is a project within the Center for Education Policy Research at Harvard University that supports education agencies in using rigorous, evidence-based, continuous improvement processes to improve outcomes for students, including addressing chronic absenteeism. And their model incorporates user-centered design with rigorous evidence generation and usage to improve attendance outcomes. And before we get into a bunch of the stats, I just want to add that this is Amber's sweet spot. This is the space that Amber and her research and her expertise has really been focusing on for a number of years. So, Amber, outside of that very brief introduction, let's start with sort of the why. So, why was the Proving Ground started, created? Why did this entire endeavor, why is this important to Harvard, and why should the rest of the world care?
I love this. This is a great place to start. I think that the origin story of Proving Ground, it predated me, but what I understand was the intention of Proving Ground was to be able to help educators and education agencies generate and use rigorous evidence to help guide decision making. And our whole goal was to support education agencies in collecting that information in a rapid cycle way so that they could test out solutions to their most pressing problems of practice that they were grappling with, and to do that in a rapid cycle way so that they would know within the scope of sometimes a semester or a full academic year, they would try something out and know, did this work or did it not? Should we continue to invest in this and should we scale it up? Should we make modifications and continue to evaluate the impact? Or should we discontinue this and say this is not a good return on our investment and that this is something that we can actually stop doing in education, which we sometimes struggle with, and use those funds to try to address other adaptive problems in a more innovative way?
And we all need that, right? And I'm really, really curious about the process by which, right? So because we all, I think, collectively can recognize that there's so much value in having data, especially real-time data that can help us make decisions. But we also know, or at least, you know, I believe we collectively have this understanding that sometimes getting our hands on that data or being able to collect data in a manner in which then I can use the data, or more importantly, can I get the data collected, to your point, fast enough somehow? Is there a process, you know, that can be incredibly problematic? And oftentimes we wait months and months and months for data to come, and we cannot do real-time course correction under that scenario. Yet that has historically been the norm. So help us understand a little bit, Amber, about how your work and what the Proving Grounds process is in terms of this rapid data collection? Because that I'm super excited about.
So our process begins with a data diagnostic. And so we support education agencies in using the data that they already have housed within their student information systems. And we give them some guiding questions to help unpack depending on what focus area they're most interested in. As it pertains to chronic absenteeism, we will ask things about the scope and magnitude. So who is most likely to be chronically absent? What is the pervasiveness? What is the magnitude of this? Are there any patterns, trends that we can discern in terms of month, time of year, days within a week, proximity to a break? How do things like discipline policies and procedures play into that? Do we notice increases in absences after students have had experience with an exclusionary discipline incident, such as a suspension? So we give them the tools to be able to really dig into that within their particular data information system. From there, we'll help them narrow into, because they will uncover a multitude of different areas that they could focus in on. And so we'll take them through a protocol to narrow into what is the specific thing that they want to investigate while they're partnering with us. And then once they narrow in on that specific thing, we'll then engage in a root cause analysis and try to help them understand, why is this occurring? You know, if it's chronic absenteeism rates are high at kindergarten and first grade, why do we see that? What's happening there? And getting a variety of different perspectives. One will certainly be the educators that participate on that team, but then also trying to get input and voice from family members, from students themselves, from other educators who may not be in the room with us, but gathering their perspectives about what might be contributors. Do they have any other data sources, such as climate surveys, information from their student information system about reasons for absences, surveys, anything that's available for them to use in real time to really try to understand what are those primary barriers? And then we'll use that information to go to the research and look at what has been found to be effective in mitigating those specific root causes that they've uncovered for their population. We'll then move into an extensive design process, thinking about that from the intended recipient of the strategy. So whether that's a teacher, a family, a student, what would it look like, sound like, feel like to experience this particular intervention? What do we want that experience to be like for them? How do we intentionally plan for that? Getting then their perspectives and feedback of, hey, this is the idea. How would it feel? What would you like? What would you not like? What would you suggest that is altered or that is enhanced for this particular strategy? Then we'll go through and design from the implementer standpoint and say, okay, if I am the person who's supposed to be leading this work, what would be expected of me? What would that look like, sound like, feel like on any given day when I'm supposed to be doing something? And then from there, we plan for implementation and how to monitor that implementation and know, is this happening, in fact, in the way that we had intended it to, the same amount of frequency, the same intensity, with the same level of adherence components? And then ultimately, we're collecting data along the way. So we're looking at, in the instance of attendance and chronic absenteeism, we're very fortunate in that that data are being tracked every single day. So we can look at that within 10, 12 weeks at a semester. We can look at that over the course of a year and do those kind of first looks or touch points to see, is this having the impact in the way that we thought that it would within the time frame in which we hypothesized that it might? Some things we know we should expect to see an impact pretty quickly. Other things that maybe are a little more relationally dependent require some trust, some building of or development of relationships. We know that takes a little bit more time as that rapport is being developed, that trust is being cultivated. So those we might expect that that time frame for seeing an impact might take a little bit longer than something like a messaging information or intervention while we're building awareness for families or for students or educators. And then we also like to collect perception data from the recipients of that, from the deliverers. How do people think that this is going? How does it feel? Is this helping? Do they like it? And using both that quantitative information about do we see reduction in absences, as well as what does the feedback say about how this feels and people's perception of it, and how easy or difficult is it to implement? And we kind of combine all of those things to help education agencies then make decisions about what do they do next.
Absolutely. I love this so much. And I think one of the things that I love the most about it is that it's so research-based. I love the fact that you go through a process and then you go out and try to find the research-based corollaries or the case studies or the example. I mean, it's a very, very rich process that you are taking these agencies through. And so I want to just start by saying how much I really appreciate that element of it because, you know, we intuitively know, well, if we do this, it'll have a positive impact. But it's nice to be able to say, does it or does it not, right? Do we have research that backs that up? And because it just makes it so much easier, right, for us to get the buy-in that we need and for us to move forward on so many different levels, whether it's funding, it's grants, there's a whole host of reasons that, so I just appreciate that very, very much about the process. But with that said, I'm also then curious a little bit, Amber, share with us about some of the things that you are seeing. We've come off of a global pandemic. You know, the world took a pause. The world has changed. There's a lot of tug right now about do we go back? Do we move forward from our educational standpoint? What does it look like? Different parts of the world are tackling this in different ways. But I would also assume that, you know, in 2024, there's some trends or some things that you are seeing, right, that influence the way ultimately you as an organization and your partner educational agencies that you're working with are moving forward because in part of some of these sorts of trends or the things that you're seeing. So I would love if we could talk a little bit about that. You're the expert in this space. And so What are we seeing right now?
So when we think about root causes or contributors, one of the frameworks that I think is helpful to kind of organize the different categories of contributors, because we know chronic absenteeism, it's multifaceted. Anytime a student is missing 10% or more of instructional days, it's often not due to one single cause. It's usually due to multiple things. But when we look at what are those large-scale patterns and trends across districts, Robert Belfans out of Johns Hopkins, as well as Attendance Works and others, have kind of developed some frameworks that we have found to be true and for most of our reasons to kind of cluster or fall under. So one of the first ones is related to barriers, or things that physically prevent students from being able to come to school. So things that fall in that category are, number one, we often see illness. So whether that is cold, flu, earache, toothache, all of those things, something in that acute category, even now COVID, bronchitis, RSV, or something that falls under a more chronic health condition, particularly in the pediatric space. So asthma, diabetes, seizure disorders, even sickle cell. So we know that there are some chronic health conditions that often contribute to why students may be missing large amounts of school. Of course, there's, you know, the random accidents, injuries, et cetera. Another reason that falls under that barriers category is often transportation.
That's the one I would have guessed. You know, I always assume like health issues. Yeah, everybody has them. They're over here. But when I hear this, I'm always like, well, what about transportation? I always think of that one first because it impacts so many systems in our communities.
Absolutely.
I'm not surprised that it's in your top three.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, how children get to and from school. Do they have reliable transportation? Do they feel safe also on their way to or from school? To what extent does weather Whether you live in the south and you have torrential downpours and hurricanes, like, or you live in the north and it's snow and cold, do you have appropriate weather gear if you're a walker? If you rely on self-transport, does your family have a reliable means of transportation? Do you have money for gas? You know, all of those things that contribute. And then if you're eligible for district transport, that's a whole other category unto itself. As many districts throughout the country have had to make really difficult decisions about what are those zones of transportation, what age and grade level that they're willing to transport or able from the budget perspective. So all of those things have played in. Another thing within that barriers category is suspensions. You know, we still are struggling in many places with how we use suspensions as a consequence. And in some places, there unfortunately still is a relationship between children who are not coming to school, whether that's cutting, whether that's truancy, and suspensions being applied as a consequence for that, or just for other, you know, difficult behaviors. But suspension is also one of those things that prevents children from being able to come to school. When we move on to that barriers or out of barriers into aversions category, that's where nothing is really physically preventing them from being able to come to school. But this is really more students are avoiding coming to school. It might be perceptions of physical or psychological safety. This might be where you see concerns of bullying, harassment. Is it safe if they walk to school or if they ride the bus? Do they feel safe on the way to or from? Do they feel like school is a place where they feel that they are competent? That school is a place where they feel that they can take academic risks, that they're supported, that they have positive relationships, kind of that connection, affiliation, sense of belonging really falls under that category.
So that's a lot of that social emotional impacts under aversion. Okay.
Yes. Exactly. And one of the number one things that we hear as it pertains to aversions is around the relationship piece. And even more so coming out of the pandemic. Pandemic is relationships between peers, relationships between adults and students in the building. Do they feel that they have connection? And does the family feel like they have a connection and sense of belonging to the school? Does this feel like a place that is welcoming, that affirms them, that they want to be in, that they can be successful academically and socially? Is one of the big things that we hear. And then the disengagement category, that's where students, nothing is physically preventing them. They're not necessarily avoiding. They're just choosing not to go. That's where we would hear the things like school is boring.
Yeah.
They don't see how it's going to help them reach their future goals. They don't necessarily see the relevance for them. And they'd rather be anyplace else other than at school.
Right.
And that's where we see, I think, connections to work-related student agency, self-determined learning of the extent to which students have choice, the extent to which they have some autonomy and ability to be able to select their kind of modes of learning to a certain extent, the things that they do learn, how they display that knowledge that they've accumulated, that plays in as well as kind of the content, the focus, the rigor of instruction and how relevant is that to them. So, and their perception of what are the real world applications.
Are you ready to join the movement to revolutionize education? Stay tuned for the full unveiling of my forthcoming book, Hacking School, 5 Strategies to Link Learning to Life, where we'll dive deeper into these topics and unlock key strategies to educational transformation. If you want to stay in the know, sign up for notifications at pastfoundation.org/hackingschool.
We hear that all the time, right? And you and I have had this conversation before, right? The kids are just trying to figure out what the heck does this have to do with them, right? And if we, as the adults in the room, cannot figure out for ourselves, right, what does it all have to do with them, then how could we possibly help them mold an experience or an environment in which they can see themselves thriving? So I appreciate that very much, because it is one of those big elements, I would argue, is that, you know, what does this have to do with me? Why do we need to learn this, you know, whatever this happens to be, when I can just look it up, right? And those are valid questions. And we need to be fostering that curiosity around asking those very, very valid questions and figuring out how we move forward. So I appreciate all of these different elements of the why chronic absenteeism happens. I am curious, Amber, that as you have been doing this work for a number of years now, and you've probably been in a variety of different environments, different settings and systems, right, that function very, very differently, I'm really, really curious if you have been surprised. Have you, without giving, you know, names or locations, but I am really curious, have you been to or worked with a place where you dug into all this data and you're like, oh, wow, I would have never guessed? The reason I'm asking this question is because, you know, we all believe our circumstance is unique. That's just part of what it means to be human, right? But the reality is, we're not as unique as we like to think. We are, in fact, biologically very unique in many ways. But from a social standpoint and the way we structure our communities and our systems, it's not so much the case. And so I'm just super curious, right? You know, does anything surprise you, or does it really sort of feel par for the course now, this far into this work around trying to tackle this epic problem, because it's everywhere?
Yeah, it's interesting. 10, 12 plus years into this work, the reasons kind of writ large no longer really surprise me, because we've heard many of them over the years, we've seen many of them, but the nuance will catch me off guard from time to time. So the big category reasons, whether it's transportation, whether it's sense of belonging, whatever it might be, that really holds fairly constant across locales, but it's the detail in the expression of that particular barrier, challenge, et cetera, in a given location for a given child, for a given family, that sometimes that catches me off guard of, wow, okay, that's why you don't feel like you belong here. And one of the things that I've done pre-pandemic, I worked with some colleagues at the University of South Florida, and we developed a survey for chronically absent students, middle school and high school students. And we went through a national validation study on it. We had almost 6,000 chronically absent secondary students respond to it from across the country. And we had some questions about perceptions of absences, because building on the work of Todd Rogers, when he looked at parents' awareness of how many absences their children had, he found that they often underestimate by 50%. They're just not tracking it. It's easy for this to, like, it's a day or two here, a day or two there. Like, it's really easy for that to just kind of fly under the radar and get to the end of the year and realize, you know, they're stunned to learn that your child has missed 16 days. So I wanted to know, our students, since they're the ones that are missing the instructional time, are they tracking this any better? And based on either their memory or their willingness to disclose to me, the answer by and large was no. They do not have any better awareness of how many absences that they've had or the implications of that. So we asked those perceptions questions, which I think is, that to me is always a, hey, step one, we need to improve our messaging. We need to build awareness. That's a really easy strategy of how do we just communicate this in a way that students are able to hear it, understand the implications on a regular basis. We also asked within there some multifaceted reasons, you know, that spanned those barriers, aversions, disengagement, you know, misconceptions, and wanted to know to what extent is it that you missed the bus, or you had car trouble, or you slept in, you stayed up too late, you couldn't get up on time for school, you were sick. And then we ask open-ended questions on, is there anything else that we didn't cover that are reasons why you miss school? Mm-hmm. What are the reasons that you do come to school, to really try to capitalize? Is there a strengths-based approach that we can take here? Is there anything we can leverage about what young people tell us is important to them and what they value? And then we ask them what ideas they have for what would help them come to school more often or result in fewer absences. So bring them in. What insights and information do you have? And after reading almost 6,000 young people's open-ended responses to those survey items, and then in the years since, several thousand more. So I've probably read comments from anywhere from 8,000 to 10,000 young people that are chronically absent in the years. And what will stun me is the things that they will tell a complete stranger on a survey about things that break their heart, and the things that are going on, whether it's in their homes or what they're experiencing at school in terms of isolation, discrimination, harassment, feeling that nobody cares about them. That always takes my breath away and stuns me in the most just unbelievable ways. But to your point around that sense of like terminal uniqueness, one of the things that I really enjoy doing is we often have districts participate in a cohort. So in a learning community so that they can learn from each other. Not everybody has to try the same strategy. You can learn from somebody else is doing a mentoring intervention or a sleep focused intervention, and we can all benefit from that, and they provide each other feedback and thought partnership. And one of my favorite activities to do is for each of the districts to then walk through the root causes that they've identified. And we have them narrow down into what we call critical roots. And that's just language we made up because they will come away with far more root causes than they could ever possibly think about addressing. So we have them prioritize them based on, does this root apply to a large number of students, families, educators, depending on what the root is focused on? Is it something that is within your sphere of influence? It's malleable. It's malleable within the time frame in which we're working. Are there other investments or energies that are focused on this particular root cause that you might be able to leverage? So all of those things we ask them to consider when they're narrowing into those, like, anywhere from 6 to 10 critical roots that they want to try to tackle. And then we have teams share those cross district. And one of my favorite things is that invariably there's this aha moment where the districts will realize, wow, we might be regionally, geographically, demographically, size-wise, very different, but we've identified all nearly identical. Yeah. And
that.
Even if it wasn't like, hey, that was a critical root, it was a contender. And maybe we didn't choose it because of X reason, but it was still on our list.
Mm-hmm. Still in my top 10, so we need to think about it. Yeah. I love that, Amber, because, again, you're bringing that community together and you're asking them to think about and look across. It essentially created this ecosystem, right? And that ecosystem has, you know, multiple components to it. And so they can find themselves in that space. I love that a lot. You know, as we wrap the conversation, I want to circle back around to one of the things that we mentioned sort of out of the gate here. And that is, as you look at all of these pieces and you've had these cohorts do this work and identify these root causes and find that they're not as different as they think they are in terms of this problem and tackling this problem. One of the things that you and I have also experienced together is a lot of work thinking about that agency and autonomy and really shifting to a learner-centered, sort of environment or ecosystem versus some of the traditional work. And so, you know, and people have different thoughts and feelings about that, and we're not going into that right now. But I do wonder if one of the trends that you've seen as sort of our last sort of thought here in our conversation today is that if and when we can modify the way students engage in education, so that more relevant, what does it have to do to me, all those pieces we talked about earlier, when we weigh that alongside the root causes that you've talked about or some of the ones that you've seen over time and identified, if changing engagement changes the way the students see themselves in the experience of education, if that then has the ability to mitigate some of the other factors that are feeding into this. So if I feel, for example, if I feel like I don't connect, I feel like I'm alone, I don't have the right relationships, but if my engagement and what I'm doing in that place changes and the people that are interacting with me, their engagement also changes, does that have the potential to positively impact that paradigm? It's a big, hairy, audacious problem, but I'm just trying to figure out some cause and effect for folks that listen, because we talk an awful lot on this program about shifting the way we engage with students.
I think the short answer is yes. That absolutely. And I think that is for many of the education agencies that we partner with, that is the same kind of hypothesis that they come to as well. If we can adjust how students engage, how people engage with them, will that shift this ecosystem in a way that they will then, for the times in which they have control over why they're absent, that maybe they make a different choice? You know, when you're sick, you're sick. If your car won't start, you miss the bus. Like sometimes you don't, that's not out of your control. But for those mornings when it's like, I don't feel like getting out of bed, or you're making a decision about when to go to sleep, or, you know, the extent to which you're experiencing some physical symptoms based on that anxiety, stress, et cetera, if we can shift how that space feels and how students interact with it and how other people in that space interact and engage with them, then our theory is that that will result in students being more likely to want to come to that space and taking perhaps additional measures to, when it's within their sphere of influence, to be there. I would say absolutely yes. That is our belief, as well as many of the districts that we've partnered with, which is why they're kind of doubling down on these kind of adaptive solutions that are so focused on relationships and shifting that climate and culture and what it means to be a young person in their educational spaces.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that. This conversation could go so many different directions. I could probably talk to you all day. But I want to thank you very much, Amber, for making time out of your day to come and have this conversation with us. There's so many things we could talk about with this. And so I would encourage our listeners to reach out. We will make sure that we have, the information about the Proving Ground and how to get access. And I have no doubt that if you reach out, there's all kinds of resources and opportunity that might be available, or at least just to know this work is happening. So, Amber, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
Thank you for joining us for Learning Unboxed, a conversation about teaching, learning, and the future of work. I want to thank my guests and encourage you all to be part of the conversation. Meet me on social media at Annalise Corbin, and join me next time as we stand up, step back, and lean in to reimagine education.